Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Okay, let's start right up with the public health news and research roundup, where I gather up all the wonderful things in the world of public health so you don't have to.
Attention listeners, as per the WAKT Pro Bono Legal Department, please note that this public health news and research roundup has no affiliation with the herbicide Roundup, which is a registered trademark of Monsanto. Also, please note that, unlike the herbicide Roundup, this public health news and research roundup is not a known human carcinogen.
First up from Politico, Trump abandoned sweeping vape ban with new slimmed-down rules. The decision is a win for some of Trump's conservative allies, who warned a more sweeping ban on flavored vaping products would alienate the president's base and weaken his re-election effort. However, the carve-outs have angered public health groups. It is a capitulation to both Juul and vape shops and gives a green light to the e-cigarette industry to continue to target and addict kids with flavored products, said Matthew Myers, president of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. The issue appeared to put Trump's top health advisors at odds with his re-election campaign and free market outside groups. Campaign manager Brad Parscale urged the president to back off a sweeping ban over concerns it could trigger backlash among his own supporters. That also put the campaign at odds with First Lady Melania Trump, who the president identified as a driving force behind the more muscular ban he initially proposed. Trump unexpectedly announced a plan for broad flavor bans in September, citing widespread teen vaping and concerns over the ongoing outbreak of vaping-linked lung illnesses. More than 50 people have been killed and more than 2,500 sickened by the illnesses, which have mostly been linked to marijuana vapes from the black market. The administration in September said it would ban menthol and mint vaping products, citing the popularity of these flavors among teens. 64% of high school vapers reported using those flavors, according to early figures from this year's National Youth Tobacco Survey. The pressure campaign to water down the ban came quickly after the initial announcement, and within days, Trump softened his rhetoric on vaping, highlighting its potential for helping adults quitting smoking. By early November, the sweeping flavor ban was dead. The only question was whether the administration would offer a watered-down version or move on from the issue. Thousands of small e-cigarette manufacturers and vape shops have warned that sweeping flavor bans would shutter an industry that's grown rapidly in recent years. Free market groups have warned that the impact could ripple into Trump's 2020 campaign efforts. One of these groups, Americans for Tax Reform, provided polling data to the White House and the Trump campaign that showed flavor bans would hurt the president, quote, in every battleground state. Public health groups were outraged when reports began circulating in October that the administration was considering whether to exempt mint and menthol. They said the new rules won't do enough to discourage teen use. Critics worry about providing any leeway on flavored products. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb this fall expressed concern that e-cigarette makers would try to game a ban just on mint vapes. The challenge with the policy of carving out menthol is Juul is likely to rename their mint to menthol, Gottlieb said. There's probably not much FDA can do when a company renames a flavor. Critics question whether limiting flavored sales to vape shops will actually curb teen use. The FDA earlier this year noted that 14.8% of teens reported getting e-cigarettes in vape shops in the past month, compared to just 8.4% who said they bought the products in a gas station or a convenience store. There is no rationale for exempting vape shops if the concern is sales to kids. Okay, backing off on that one. What else is new? Okay, well, in this new year, let's do a story. This from NPR. 7 women's health topics we need to talk about in 2020. As the decade changes and we consider the state of women's health in America, who better to turn to than the authors of 5 taboo-busting books from 2019 that took on issues that generations of women haven't been talking about but need to. We asked these outspoken doctors and health advocates to give us their top 7 messages to women for 2020. Here's what they said. Number 1. Better birth control is possible and necessary. Because birth control has been an incredible force in the lives of women, allowing them to achieve and even set long-term educational goals and career goals and achieve gains towards economic parity with men, there's a taboo about talking about it critically for fear that it will be taken away and our gains with it, said Sarah Hill, author of This Is Your Brain on Birth Control, The Surprising Science of Women, Hormones, and the Law of Unintended Consequences. Hill wants to see more investment in research and development of better birth control. Hormonal birth control influences the brain in ways that make people uncomfortable to acknowledge, she says, including whom a woman finds attractive as a mate, and to some degree, how she responds to stress. It used to seem like the best defense against sexist rhetoric was to pretend as if these effects didn't exist at all, Hill says, but sticking your head in the sand is no way to advocate for a better future for women. It can be uncomfortable acknowledging the flaws of hormonal contraception while simultaneously fighting to make it accessible, Hill says, but adds, it's a trade-off. We have to find a way to live in this discomfort while we push for improvements. Women deserve better. Number 2. Most, quote, vaginal health products are bogus. One of the most pernicious myths is that vaginas are in a constant state of near catastrophe and need cleaning and repair, says Dr. Jen Gunter, New York Times columnist and author of The Vagina Bible, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine. Forget all these myths, she says. Your vagina has got things covered. The messaging that a woman's genitalia needs constant upkeep with things like special feminine washes, douches, hair removers, wipes, and tighteners is mostly promoted by companies that want to make women feel insecure so they'll buy something, she explains. If our genitalia requires special care, we never would have evolved this way. In general, Gunter says, it's a bad idea to rely on information from a source that's also trying to sell you something. 3. Transgender women are women. Gunter writes about gender transition and what she has heard from parents of trans kids is that it provided them with medical information that they weren't getting anywhere else, even from their primary health care provider. What it comes down to is simple. Having a vagina isn't what makes you a woman. It's how you feel inside, said Gunter. We shouldn't reduce anyone to their body parts, but it happens more with women, and especially with trans women. Ultimately, she says, parts are parts, and people are people. 4. Women's pain is real. For years, Abby Norman experienced extreme menstrual symptoms and extraordinary abdominal pain during sex, but doctors wrote her off. They implied they thought my pain was psychological, she says. It was only when she started to bring her boyfriend with her to appointments that she felt taken seriously. All of a sudden, things changed. All I could think was, why wasn't enough when I was saying it? Why is it that being a disappointment to the man in your life is a sign that things need to change? Norman wrote about her experience, which culminated in a diagnosis of endometriosis. In her memoir, Ask Me About My Uterus, A Quest to Make Doctors Believe in Women's Pain, she says the big takeaway, besides the need for more awareness and understanding of endometriosis, is that doctors need to acknowledge that women are capable of knowing themselves. This phenomenon can be compounded when the patients are women of color. 5. It's time to rethink menopause. According to historian Susan Mattern, when women in pre-modern agrarian societies would exit their reproductive age, it was viewed as an upgrade, an entrance into a really important life phase. Mattern is the author of The Slow Moon Climbs, The Science, History, and Meaning of Menopause. Too much emphasis in mass market books about menopause, she says, is placed on menopause treatments, or lack thereof. The modern way of thinking about menopause isn't the only way, she says, and other ways might serve us better. Madden says humans have been a long-lived species for quite some time and were engineered by evolution to live into our 70s and thrive in our post-reproductive years. She says that what's new is the stigma attached to old age. We tend to think that aging is bad, that only young people are useful. But if we're not appreciating what's going on during the rest of our lifespan, we're not understanding who we are. 6. Vagina, labia, clitoris. It's okay to talk about them. These clinical terms are often treated like dirty words, and that's a problem, Gunter says. When you can't say a word, the implication is that it's shameful and that it shouldn't be talked about, and that stifles your ability to find out what's typical versus what might be a medical condition. Regularly, she says, women come to her office, and even behind closed doors, they can't hardly say the words to describe what's wrong with their reproductive tract. They'll even say to me, I don't know why I'm having trouble saying this, and that's not to disparage the women. That's just how effective the culture of shame is, even today. The danger of being unable to speak freely about bodies, Gunter says, is twofold. If women can't discuss health concerns with their doctor, not only will they miss out on treatment, but they will also get bad advice from less reputable clandestine sources. 7. Women's rights are human rights. Jennifer Weiss Wolf is fighting to end what she calls the tampon tax, which still exists in 32 states. She outlines the case against the taxation of menstrual products in her book, Periods Gone Public, Taking a Stand for Menstrual Equity. It's time to connect these issues to the ways society marginalizes certain other groups and push for greater dignity and justice for people experiencing homelessness or incarceration as well. Next up from the Hill, advocates hopeful gun violence research funding will lead to prevention. Doctors and advocates are hopeful that new funding for federal agencies to study gun violence will prove to be the first step in preventing mass shootings, suicides, and other firearm deaths. For the first time in 23 years, a government spending bill will set aside funds, in this case $25 million, for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the National Institutes of Health to collect data on what the American Medical Association has called a public health crisis. Activists are optimistic that getting fresh data will provide policymakers with the information needed to reduce gun deaths. Government funding for gun violence research came to a halt in 1996 when Congress passed an amendment to a spending bill blocking federal agencies from advocating for gun control. As a result, research projects at the CDC and the NIH were stopped. The move also had a chilling effect on other researchers, creating a void in what experts know about gun violence in the U.S. Some of the questions that need answering are, what are the causes? What works to prevent it? And how do you do it? But that's just the tip of the iceberg. Researchers also don't have good answers to questions like, who are the victims? How are they getting shot? And with what kinds of firearms? Where did the weapons come from? What are the relationships between shooters and victims? What's the role of mental illness, drugs, and alcohol? What is the relationship between domestic violence and gun violence? While some states and municipalities have passed measures aimed at reducing gun violence, a dearth of government research has prevented policymakers from determining whether their efforts have been effective. The CDC still has the largest collection of violence prevention professionals of any place in the world. People are ready to work on that question, and they can do it in an absolutely objective, high-quality, scientific way. Dr. Georges Benjamin, executive director of the American Public Health Association, said the CDC and NIH could also study ways to reduce suicides with firearms and how to make guns safer. Public health experts have long urged policymakers to treat gun violence as a public health issue, like motor vehicle deaths or lung cancer. Smoking rates and automobile fatalities declined after researchers studied the issue and found methods of intervention that worked, like taxes on cigarettes and mandatory seatbelt laws. We recognize gun violence as a public health issue that must be addressed in that way, said Dr. Joseph Wright, a member of the American Academy of Pediatrics Board of Directors. Wright was leading a CDC-funded project on gun violence in 1996, but it was ended because of the funding ban. I have been haunted over the last couple of decades by the work we could have accomplished and, frankly, the deaths and injuries that could have been prevented if we were able to continue that work, he said. Ever since funding was cut in the mid-90s, public health experts have fought to get federal funding for research. Those efforts got a major boost this year when Democrats took control of the House. Democrats originally sought $50 million, but negotiations with Republicans cut that amount in half. Still, they said, they plan to ask for more funding in future spending bills. Next up, from the American Heart Association. Long work hours at the office link to both regular and hidden high blood pressure. Office workers who spend long hours on the job are more likely to have high blood pressure, including a type that can go undetected during a routine medical appointment, according to a new study published today in the American Heart Association's journal Hypertension. High blood pressure affects nearly half of Americans age 18 and older and is a primary factor in more than 82,000 deaths per year. Approximately 15 to 30% of U.S. adults have a type of the condition called masked hypertension, meaning their high blood pressure readings are normal during healthcare visits but elevated when measured elsewhere. Working 49 or more hours each week was linked to a 70% greater likelihood of having mass hypertension and a 66% greater likelihood of having sustained hypertension, elevated blood pressure readings in and out of clinical settings. Working between 41 and 48 hours each week was linked with a 54% greater likelihood of having mass hypertension and a 42% greater likelihood of having sustained hypertension. The findings accounted for variables such as job strain, age, sex, education level, occupation, smoking status, body mass index, and other factors. From the Washington Post, processed meat recalls rise dramatically as consumers bite down on metal, plastic, and glass. Bits of metal, hard plastic, rubber, and even glass are increasingly getting mixed and baked into processed meat products reaching consumers, triggering a record number of safety recalls, a Washington Post analysis of federal records shows. So far this year, the Agriculture Department has announced 34 recalls involving 17 million pounds of meat products after stray materials were found in them. I think that year meant 2019. That's a sharp increase from a decade ago. In 2009, when there were five such recalls involving about 1 million pounds of processed meat, metal parts are breaking off machines that mix, chop, and puree ingredients. Plant workers' rubber gloves are falling into the meat mixes, and bits of plastic and glass from meat packaging and ingredient containers are getting ground into the food. The makers of some of the most beloved and recognizable ready-made food staples have issued the recalls, which have included Tyson Foods chicken tenders, Jimmy Dean sausages, and Spam. The stray items, which the USDA calls foreign objects, are typically found after a consumer bites into a meat product, records show, sometimes chipping teeth in the process. The objects can cause choking and can injure the intestinal tract. There is the initial shock when you find something that clearly does not belong, such as a screw or shrapnel or packing material, said Robert Rausch, a New York food safety lawyer. It's shock. It's disgust. The concern always is whether there were other pieces that you swallowed. It's like the old joke. What is worse than finding a worm in your apple? It's finding half a worm. The Post examined more than 150 USDA recall notices for foreign object contamination from 2009 to 2019. For each recall, the Post recorded the manufacturer's name, type of food, pounds of recalled product, type of foreign material, and the manner in which the contamination was discovered. The analysis showed the spike in recalls began in 2016. Pieces of plastic accounted for nearly half of the recalls of foreign objects and metal for nearly 25%. The rest of the recalled food was contaminated with either rubber, glass, cardboard, or wood. The USDA does not have the power to order a recall. It can only recommend one based on what it knows about contamination of a product. Three USDA inspectors, speaking on the condition of anonymity because they feared retribution, also said the faster line speeds, antiquated equipment, and poor maintenance are playing the larger roles in the increase. The inspectors, along with food safety experts, say they should spend more time at processing facilities. Unlike USDA inspectors at slaughterhouses, where federal workers must be present at all times during operation, inspectors at processing plants sometimes spend as little as 1 or 2 hours at a plant before jumping onto the next one. This means inspectors have time to review the plant's written procedures for preventing contamination, but little else. If all they are doing is checking the company's own paperwork, they aren't inspecting, they are doing an audit, said Tony Corbo, senior lobbyist with the nonprofit Food and Water Watch. And in a somewhat related story, the whole meat industry and livestock production, from Forbes, animal agriculture costs more in health damage than it contributes to the economy. U.S. farms cost the economy more in health and environmental damage than they contribute to the economy, according to the recent study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of the Sciences. For 20 economic sectors, the study compared the costs of premature deaths from particulate air pollution to the value added to the economy. Farms performed worst, driven down by animal agriculture. The study, conducted with researchers from Carnegie Mellon University, focused on particulate pollution, including PM2.5, which the EPA has identified as the cause of 90% of the 100,000 annual premature deaths in the U.S. from air pollution. The study does not include health costs from consuming animal products, nor does it include the economic costs of other forms of pollution, such as greenhouse gas emissions and their impact on the climate. This work is not advocating that we should shut down agriculture in the United States. It is providing the intuition that, at the margin, the damages are larger than the value provided, so we'll need to think about this sector more seriously. The economist Juan Moreno Cruz says, agriculture emissions remain stubbornly high and exhibit a flat trend, making agriculture one of the most polluting industries per dollar in the United States right now. And sticking on this theme, this from CBC, completely unsustainable, how streaming and other data demands take a toll on the environment. The gigabytes of data we're using, although invisible, come at a significant cost to the environment. Some experts say it rivals that of the airline industry. And as more smart devices rely on data to operate, think internet-connected refrigerators or self-driving cars, their electricity demands are set to skyrocket. It's not the gadgets themselves that are drawing so much power. It's the far-flung servers that act as their electronic brains. Although often described as the cloud, the servers exist in real-world data centers, which are massive energy hogs. Calculations published in the International Journal of Green Technology suggest data centers could more than double their power demands over the next decade. Computing will gobble up to 11% of global energy by 2030, and cloud-based services will represent a sizable proportion of that. This will become completely unsustainable by 2040. So what's driving the increased demand for data? Streaming video is currently the biggest culprit, with platforms like Netflix and Amazon Prime Video eating up 60.6% of all internet traffic. And streaming video usage is only growing. But higher speed 5G cellular networks, more widespread artificial intelligence, and the nascent Internet of Things, such as smart home devices, are guaranteed to send data demands through the roof. Autonomous vehicles, for instance, require a constant flow of information to stay on the road. The information and communications technology sector as a whole is thought to currently be responsible for 2-3% of global greenhouse gas emissions, roughly on par with the often criticized airline sector. Okay, another interesting article, this from the New York Times. The IRS sent a letter to 3.9 million people. It saved some of their lives. 3 years ago, 3.9 million Americans received a plain-looking envelope from the Internal Revenue Service. Inside was a letter stating that they had recently paid a fine for not carrying health insurance and suggesting possible ways to enroll in coverage. New research concludes that the bureaucratic mailing saved lives. Three Treasury Department economists have published a working paper finding that these notices increased health insurance signups. Obtaining insurance, they said, reduced premature deaths by an amount that exceeded any of their expectations. Americans between 45 and 50 and 64 benefited the most. For every 1,648 who received a letter, one fewer death occurred among those who hadn't received a letter. In all, the researchers estimated that the letters may have wound up saving 700 lives. The experiment, an unintended result of a budget shortfall, is the first rigorous experiment to find that health coverage leads to fewer deaths, a claim that politicians and economists have fiercely debated in recent years as they assess the effects of the Affordable Care Act's coverage expansion. The result also provides belated vindication for the much-despised individual mandate that was part of Obamacare until December 2017, when Congress did away with the fine for people who don't carry health insurance. The uninsured rate for Americans is rising for the first time in a decade, as states tighten eligibility rules for Medicaid and as the Trump administration cuts back on health care outreach. It's an innovation to know that just sending a letter to people with information about what it means to be insured versus uninsured can substantially change coverage rates, said Catherine Baker, Dean of the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. That is really important, new information. Okay. Here's an interesting perspective on Medicare for All from The Hill. Medicare for All ignores a bigger problem. Our current election cycle is dominated by discussions about how to make medical care accessible and affordable. It is a priority as more Americans face medical bankruptcy to pay for their or their family's medical care or are forced to choose between food and medication. But the energy, time, and attention given to this discussion ignore the impact that systemic societal problems have on our health and our increasing need for medical care. Medical care spending accounts for nearly a fifth of our country's gross domestic product, and Medicaid alone accounts for about one-fifth of state budget expenditures annually. Despite this spending, the life expectancy of Americans is lower than in other wealthy countries and continues to decline. That's because paying for medical care does nothing to address what's making people sick. Bugs and bacteria no longer drive our medical care costs, but by community-level factors like educational disparities, neighborhood safety, and racism, issues over which we as individuals have little control. Much of the airtime during the 2020 Democratic primary debates has been dedicated to discussing Medicare for All. Medicare for All, who won it, or whatever name we finally settle on, there's been little mention of the 37.2 million Americans living in food insecure households, the 60% decline in affordable housing between 2010 and 2016, or the 2.3 million Americans who have been evicted from their homes each year, each of which has significant impact on health. Housing instability has been associated with worse self-reported health, elevated blood pressure, and depression. Similarly, food insecurity has been associated with everything from diabetes to depression to hypertension. Both are associated with postponing medical care and medications and increased hospitalizations. Unless we address these community-level causes of disease, a sole focus on access to and paying for medical care creates an endless cycle of poor health. Improving health will be possible only when we address the hostile environment that exists in far too many American communities. Our declining health also puts our nation's prosperity at risk. Like many political leaders, billionaire investor Warren Buffett has been an advocate of single-payer medical insurance programs as a way to control the $880 billion in medical care benefits U.S. employers pay every year. But while Medicare for All and similar proposals may control escalating costs and move them away from employers, it won't reduce the $530 billion in illness-related lost productivity, equal to the 2018 revenues of Apple and Amazon combined, from diseases like diabetes, $90 billion a year, and heart disease and stroke, $131 billion a year. Creating communities where people can live longer, better lives requires us to prioritize smart passing policy, not just pay for bills and procedures. Our nation's cities and counties provide examples of how to use regulatory and legislative action to build healthy, thriving, and prosperous communities. Municipalities throughout the country are building safer streets where residents can actively commute to work, levying taxes and requiring new developments to include affordable units to increase housing stock, providing quality housing through rental inspection ordinances, ensuring that parks and playgrounds are well lit for youth to be active, and build community and increasing access to healthy food at local farmers markets and supermarkets. As politicians continue to debate whether access to medical care is a human right, they should also be discussing the necessary plans and policies to ameliorate homelessness, hunger, poor education, and income disparities. No amount of medical insurance can solve these and other entrenched social problems. We know that confronting economic and social conditions can create a healthy population and a thriving and prosperous nation. The question is, why do we lack the political will to do it? Okay, our next story is a good piece on the intersection between healthcare and societal issues. This is an editorial from the Toledo Blade, "Treatment, Not Cold Shoulders." If Ohio is going to solve its crushing opioid epidemic, the state is going to need more drug treatment facilities. And that means cities like Toledo are going to have to improve the way they manage proposals to build those treatment centers in their communities. Toledo's moratorium on granting permits for new drug treatment facilities in District 4 is set to expire at the end of the year, which means the city must have a new plan for responsibly and reasonably granting permission for the treatment centers the region needs. Earlier this month, city planners presented findings of an 18-month study about what impact, if any, such treatment facilities have on Toledo neighborhoods. The study and the moratorium stem from requests by City Councilman, Councilwoman Yvonne Harper, the Blade, whose District 4 has what she and some of her constituents think is an unfair concentration of such facilities. City planners have suggested Toledo encourage treatment center developers to locate new facilities in neighborhoods where there are fewer treatment centers. Also at issue is the fact that Toledo treats drug treatment centers differently than in other Ohio cities, something Toledo should consider revising. In Columbus, Dayton, and Cleveland, cities that also suffer high rates of opioid addiction, outpatient drug and alcohol treatment facilities face fewer regulations than in Toledo. In Toledo, these services are treated differently than other healthcare providers, which concerns some council members, as it should. Scott Silak, Executive Director of the Mental Health and Recovery Services Board of Lucas County, has called on City Council to reform its regulations to treat drug and alcohol treatment facilities just as it does nursing homes and other medical facilities. Council should take his suggestion. A 2017 study by Ohio State University researchers concluded that Ohio had enough drug treatment facilities to accommodate only 20% to 40% of people who need treatment in the state. That's not only woefully inadequate, it is cruel. That drastic lack of access to treatment will doom Ohio to never escape the grip of the ongoing drug addiction crisis. Toledo must reform its regulations and permitting procedure to remove the barriers that are keeping responsible addiction treatment facilities out of the city. Toledo suburbs also must consider what obstacles their communities are putting up to prevent much-needed additional treatment facilities from opening to serve the region. The people who need drug treatment are our neighbors. They suffer in our neighborhoods now, and they will return to our neighborhoods to live once they have completed treatment for their addiction. Those treatment centers that help them will be in someone's neighborhood. It is every community's responsibility to help increase access to the treatment our neighbors need. And as you may have noticed, as I noted in the introduction to this show, I'm a longtime resident of the Old West End, which is in District 4. We have a wondrous array of big old houses that are used office for group homes and all kinds of stuff. This has led to, an unusual concentration of such places. There's been much controversy about this. I, one resident, a long-term resident of that neighborhood, welcome that we use this asset to make our community a better place. Please don't be scared of people who need help in our community. Okay, let's end the show with some good news. This from Science Daily. Your DNA is not your destiny or a good predictor of your health. In most cases, your genes have less than 5% to do with your risk of developing a particular disease, according to new research by University of Alberta scientists. In the largest meta-analysis ever conducted, scientists have examined two decades of data from studies that examine the relationships between common gene mutations, also known as single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, and different diseases and conditions. And the results show that the links between most human diseases and genetics are shaky at best. Simply put, DNA is not your destiny. And SNPs are duds for disease prediction, said David Wishart, professor of the University of Alberta's Department of Biological Sciences and the Department of Computing Science and co-author of the study. The vast majority of diseases, including many cancers, diabetes, and Alzheimer's disease, have a genetic contribution of 5 to 10% at best. The study also highlights some notable exceptions, including Crohn's disease, celiac disease, and macular degeneration, which have a genetic contribution of approximately 40 to 50%. Despite these rare exceptions, it's becoming increasingly clear that the risks for getting most diseases arise from your metabolism, your environment, your lifestyle, or your exposure to various kinds of nutrients, chemicals, bacteria, or viruses, explained Wishart. This gets at one of my pet peeves, is seeing all kinds of research that seems to focus on some kind of reductionistic, deterministic DNA evolutionary, destiny or something, which I think is very much overblown. I think in general, the research that when you're asking, is it genetics or is it environment, usually puts the genetic component perhaps somewhere in the range of a quarter to a third. So environment definitely rules. That, I think, is actually good news for our ability to change things at a societal and an individual level. Okay, let's end with news from the World Health Organization. Good news. drop in cholera cases worldwide as key endemic countries report gains in cholera control. The number of cholera cases decreased globally by 60% in 2018, the World Health Organization announced in a report that points to an encouraging trend in cholera prevention and control in the world's major cholera hotspots, including Haiti, Somalia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The decrease we are seeing in several major cholera endemic countries demonstrates the increased engagement of countries in global efforts to slow and prevent cholera outbreaks and shows the vital role of mass cholera vaccination campaigns, said WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus. We continue to emphasize, however, that the long-term solution for ending cholera lies in increasing access to clean drinking water and providing adequate sanitation and hygiene. This global decrease in case numbers we are observing appears to be linked to large-scale vaccination campaigns and countries beginning to adopt the Global Roadmap to 2030 strategy in their national cholera action plans, said Dr. Dominique Legros, who heads WHO's cholera program in Geneva. We must continue to strengthen our efforts to engage all cholera endemic countries in this global strategy to eliminate cholera. Nearly 18 million doses of oral cholera vaccine were shipped to 11 countries in 2018. Since the oral cholera vaccine stockpile was created in 2013, almost 60 million doses have been shipped worldwide. Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, has provided funding for purchase for the vaccine and financial support for the global vaccination drives. The Global Task Force on Cholera Control launched the Global Roadmap Strategy for Effective Long-Term Cholera Control and Elimination in October 2017. The Global Roadmap aims to reduce cholera deaths by 90% and to eliminate transmission in up to 20 countries by 2030. The strategy provides a framework for national action plans that emphasizes three main axes of cholera control: early detection and rapid response to contain outbreaks, a multi-sectorial approach integrating strength in surveillance, vaccination, community mobilization, and water, sanitation, and hygiene to prevent cholera in hotspots in endemic countries, an effective mechanism of coordination for technical support, resource mobilization, and partnership at the local and global levels. The Global Roadmap provides clear guidance on how to prevent and ultimately to eliminate cholera. Every death from cholera is preventable with the tools we have today. The new report shows several countries, including Zambia, South Sudan, United Republic of Tanzania, Somalia, Bangladesh, and Nigeria, have made significant progress in developing national action plans within the framework. We are seeing the results of countries reporting and acting on cholera, and these countries are making remarkable gains in cholera control and prevention. Cholera is an acute diarrheal infection caused by ingestion of food or water contaminated with the bacterium Vibrio cholerae. Cholera affects both children and adults and can kill within hours if left untreated. WHO estimates that each year cholera infects 1 to 4 million people and claims up to 143,000 lives. Okay, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com, or you can queue up this show to listen again or any other future show at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.